From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Who are you? The name on your driver's license? The title on your business card? A random combination of genes and environment? Or are you, in fact, a story? The tale you tell of your ups and downs, past and present, hopes and dreams. New science suggests that the self is just a web of neurons holding a collection of stories. But who's telling the story? This hour, creators, contemplatives, and scientists hunt for the truest story of the self. What does it mean to say that your identity, who you think you are, is just a story? I mean, I don't feel fictional. So let's go first to psychologist and researcher Jonathan Adler for a crash course in narrative identity. You've studied a lot of people and the stories they tell about themselves. What do we know about how we construct ourselves? Who do we think we are?
Well, I think the first point of that is that we do make sense of ourselves in a storied way. Stories seem to be the sort of baseline way in which we approach making order out of the world.
When you start to say you're telling a story about yourself, that sounds as though we're making something up.
There are ways in which we absolutely are. I talk about people's stories as the most important fiction. So memory research tells us that we are not particularly accurate reporters of the things that happen to us, but the stories that we tell about our lives are based on a true story. So they have some kind of correspondence with capital R reality. But we are constantly doing this interpretive and reconstructive thing as we make sense of our lives.
Do we change stories in order to reconstruct our lives in ways that we like better?
Well, like better, again, sort of implies this purposeful, premeditated way of reconstructing our memory. And certainly one can do that. But I think this process happens at much less of a conscious level, that we take the things that happen to us and we do reconstitute them to align with some kind of current psychological need, which is not to say you can't do it in a purposeful way. And that's actually one of the things that I'm very interested in. How can we take the stories that we tell about our experiences and restory them in ways that might better support our mental health?
Well, of course, any writer will tell you that there are a lot of different ways to tell a story. Is that what we're talking about? That our narrative self-concepts are just different ways of telling the same story?
Yes, absolutely. And to put it in sort of the scholarly jargon, we talk about narrative identity. The best way to understand our sense of self is as a story. And absolutely, there are better and worse ways of telling those stories, better and worse in terms of their mental health implications. I have a recent study that just came out this month, actually, in February. What I was interested in was the way people's stories evolved over the course of psychotherapy. So presumably when people first come to therapy, there's something that's not working for them in their lives and therefore in their stories. In this study, we got people before they had ever seen a therapist and we had them tell their story. We also assessed their mental health. And then in between every therapy session, for the first 12 sessions, we again had them tell their stories in this private way. We had them write them. It wasn't like they were telling the stories to their therapist. And we looked at the evolution of the themes in their stories alongside the evolution of their mental health. And we were looking at the specific thematic ways in which their stories changed. So one of the key themes that showed up was this theme we call agency, which is really the way you portray the main character in your story. So are you portraying the main character, i.e. you, as someone who's in the driver's seat of their experiences or really being batted around at the whims of external circumstances? So we saw that agency increased across people who got better over the course of therapy. But we also found that the stories started to change before people got better. So it's not that the storied change was some kind of side effect of feeling better. The stories actually shifted first.
How difficult is it for people to make this kind of narrative change in the stories they tell of their lives?
That's a very good question. So in the study that I was just describing, we were just studying what happened naturally over the course of therapy. So that suggests to me that this is something people are naturally doing anyway. We're not specifically looking at people telling their stories in a more positive way. So this is not just put a rosy glow on your past and everything will be better. The best stories, meaning the ones that have the strongest association with positive mental health, are the ones where people really get in there and find some way of growing or learning some kind of lesson from it.
I don't want you to break anybody's confidence, but I wonder if you could give me a more specific example of someone's story and the ways in which it changed.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the research report, we have a case study which is carefully de-identified. So she came to therapy after two very brief and failed courses of family therapy and group therapy. And at the beginning of her treatment, before she ever saw her therapist, her story is just infused with this low agency language. And as we track her story over the 12 narratives that she tells us, we see increasing levels of agency. So about halfway through therapy, she talks about feeling a little bit more in control. And then by the end, she has this really sort of hyperbolic in a, you know, deliciously teenager sort of way, where she talks about feeling empowered for greatness. And these were written narratives, and she writes in all capital letters with 4 exclamation points. And so we really see that evolution in this sense of how much she feels like she's in the driver's seat of her life. And that corresponds to and actually precedes the improvements that she also experienced in her mental health.
When you look at the way in which stories change, you don't mean that that it's the same story over the whole time. So you're not tracking content. You're tracking instead the way in which the story is told.
That's exactly right. The specific content of people's stories does change over time. So if I were to ask you to tell me the high point of your life right now, and then I were to ask you that same question again in 5 years, you might tell me a different high point story, and even if it's not because a new high point happened in your life. But the themes that you use in telling that story are actually remarkably stable. And so that's what we tend to look at. How do the themes change or not over time?
How difficult is it to learn to tell more helpful stories of ourselves?
Well, I don't think anyone has done a study where they've explicitly tried to coach people into telling a certain kind of story. But we do this naturally. And I think if you become aware of the relationship between the way you tell your story and your mental health, I'm quite confident that people can change that.
What do you think they would say if you were to say, your story has changed?
People tend to really like the realization that they are not only the main character in their stories, but they're also the narrator. I think they realize, hey, I can't control the things that happen to me, but I can control the meaning that I make of the things that happen to me.
It occurs to me the opposite could almost as easily be true. If you begin to think, oh, my word, I'm just telling a story of my life. How real is the story I've been telling myself? That could be pretty unsettling.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. I've never really thought about it from that sort of dark interpretation, but I guess it could throw people into this sort of existential crisis of what is there if it's all just my story. I definitely read it in the other way, that this means that you're in control of the story that you're telling.
Well, one of the nice things, I would think, is that it could lead to some contemplation.
And contemplation in and of itself could go either way. But I think if people become aware that the ways in which they story the experiences that happen to them matter for their mental health, it at least opens up the possibility for them to do that in a more productive way. So some people take the negative and they parse it at the beginning of the story. So this bad thing happened, but from that bad thing, I learned something or I grew. And that kind of redemption sequence, that's really good for people's mental health. In the opposite direction, people sometimes parse it where the negative event happens at the end of the story. So everything was going along fine, and then this happened. And all of a sudden, the negativity of the end of the story overwhelms the beginning of the story. And that we call a contamination sequence. And that's really bad for mental health.
I was thinking still about contemplation and about mystics, contemplatives. They often say that disengaging from your idea of self can lead to a more peaceful life. Is it possible for us to stop telling ourselves stories of who we are?
That's a really interesting question, and not one that I've contemplated a lot before. I mean, I guess I don't want to call into question the possibility that people can reach some kind of enlightened state, that's kind of selfless state. But I think the average person, and certainly the average person in contemporary Western culture, lives in their stories. That it's the way we make sense of the world, and it's really hard to get beyond that.
Jonathan Adler is a researcher and assistant professor of psychology at Olin College. Do you want to tell a different kind of story about yourself? Producer Sarah Nix says, forget it.
Want to know the story behind why you're hearing this show right now? However true or fictional, here it is. As the only child of a single parent, my mother's story shaped my life. It was not joyful or pleasant, and the moral was this: life is difficult, you're not safe, trust no one, expect bad things. My mother would have small dinner parties, invite old friends, and recite the saga of herself. It was a tale of victimhood and pain, of her own brittle defiance and brilliant will. When I was a kid, my mother was the center of my world. I watched her carefully. I believed her biography of hardship and then saw her choose over and over again to make her life difficult. As her child, her ever-available audience, she tried to make her story my story. And she did, until I saw that her story was only her interpretation of events. For a while, I tried to show her the truth, that life could be different, that she didn't need to repeat and repeat and repeat the past. It didn't work. Rebellious, I tried to craft a story of myself that was the opposite of hers. If she was a valley, I would be a mountain. If she was shadow, I would be sunshine. I told myself that I was compassionate, I was trusting and easygoing. I would not see life as difficult, and I would not have children. Think of that cliched vignette. A woman in her 30s is reprimanding her child or fussing over a spouse, and then her hands fly to her mouth, she groans and thinks, "Oh God, I'm becoming my mother." For years, I worked hard to avoid ever having one of those moments. My mother has Alzheimer's now. Memory by memory, she's lost the story of why she is the way she is. As the disease stripped away her personal mythology, she didn't seem to feel more free. She seemed more afraid. After her diagnosis, I realized how few true facts I knew about her life. I asked questions to try to fill the gaps. She got confused. She couldn't answer. With no living siblings, no spouse, and no memory, my mother's story is fading fast. I'm supposed to feel sad about that. But honestly, right now, I feel free. Remember when I mentioned those dinner parties? Those stages upon which my mother performed her theater of self? There's a reason why I didn't regale you with her sagas. I don't believe them. They're not true. They are just myth and misshapen memory. As I get older, I also believe my own stories less and less. They're powerful, but false. As I stop believing in my stories, a lot of comforting myths begin to look like lies as well. God, romance, even the idea of myself. Disbelief doesn't feel comfortable. But it does feel true.
That's TT Book producer Sarah Nix. This isn't the first time we've questioned consciousness. Want to dig through our archives? You can find them online at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Are you driving right now? Well, if not, just take a second here to do a little exercise with me. Okay. Press your thumb to the bridge of your nose. Now, draw it slowly over the crown of your head to about where you might have a ponytail. That area under your skull is where you are. Well, at least that's what the brain scientists think. That's also where the you who knows your you lives. But how does it all work? Julian Keenan studies the neuroscience of the self, and Strange Chimps spoke with him.
You know, this age-old question, how do you know your you? It's a hard question to ask. Who's the I asking the question?
Right. That's one of the first complicated questions here. In science, we call it the Cartesian theater, the idea that there's someone inside my head looking at someone inside my head who's looking at someone inside my head, and you keep going in that circle. And immediately from that problem, we jump to a new problem, which is once I figure out that I'm me, how do I know that you're you?
Self-awareness is painful. A lot of the time. I mean, you know, some people are obviously more self-conscious than others, but almost all of us have had the experience. You get up, you get dressed in the morning, you look at yourself in the mirror and you think, oh, I wish I were in better shape. Or you have to give a talk in front of a lot of people and you feel like you're just going to die of self-consciousness. Why is our self-awareness painful a lot of the time?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's the one I love to talk about. I think it's because I'm an evolutionist that I'm so negative. The negative aspects of the self are clear. I don't think, as I'm speaking here today, my cat is ruminating about a slight she's had in the past and she's planning for the future. Certainly not to the extent that I'm able to do it. The resentments that build, we go back in the past and we play out what we should have said. We go into the future and we say, I'm going to say this. And when you don't say that, then you have another chance to go in the back in the past and hate yourself. So clearly having a self can be a curse. And what we look at is how the self helps create a deceptive world and how it winds up leading to a lot of self-deception.
Wait, what do you mean? So we're having a sense of self means sort of inescapably that we're lying to ourselves?
I think so. You know, I went into this pretty naive. I was thinking, you know, and I think most people think this way, that the self is a wonderful thing to have. It leads to art and music and just tremendous things like jazz and abstractionism and great literature. However, on the other side, as psychological studies began to come out, a number of interesting findings were being published. One was the strength of false memories and how many of our memories are, in fact, not real memories. And then another sort of line of research was coming out showing how often people deceive not only to others but to themselves. So we think that one of the key components of the self is molding reality not so that it's real but so that it's palatable.
Wow. So my sense of self is really kind of a story or even a lie that I tell myself in order to kind of ease my progress through life?
Yeah, and it gets worse. I don't know if you want to hear the "and it gets worse" part.
Yeah, go ahead.
But there's a whole line of research that then shows that one of the things the self may be doing is leading you to believe you have free will when you have no free will. For example, a series of elegant experiments from the 80s by someone named Labette began to demonstrate that when we reach for an object, so right now I'm reaching for a cup, the arm moves first, and then the frontal lobe gets involved, or the self gets involved after the decision is made. And what the self does is thinks that it made the decision, but the arm was moving before the self even knew that the arm was moving. So there's this idea that free will is an illusion, and your sense of self helps to create that illusion that you have free will.
Wait, you mean the body moves first, and then the brain catches up, but then why does the body move? Why did you reach for the cup?
Well, what we think is that there are these areas of the brain that get involved that are reptilian old parts of the brain. They've been around for a long time, and, you know, they're very reflexive, and, you know, they're just tied into some very basic motor systems. And they get engaged, and then your arm moves, and about 2 seconds later, then your frontal lobe gets involved and says, oh, yeah, I meant to move it.
What does that say about higher orders of decisions that we make? You know, I'm going to invest in this stock, or I'm going to take the job, or
I'm going to marry this person.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at that right now. Right now, you know, we have this study planned. We're having people make a decision of two very benign objects, two different coffee cups, two different garbage cans, two different blades of grass. And what we think is that we can influence which direction they go in by biasing one of their hemispheres. And after they make this decision, they'll come up with a perfectly rational explanation for why they've decided it.
How do you bias somebody's hemispheres?
Well, we have wonderful machine known as a transcranial magnetic stimulator. So creating the bias isn't the magic. We've known about that for a long time. It's once people have that bias in their brain, will they realize that they have it? And we're pretty sure that they won't, that they'll come up with any other explanation like, you know, I like that garbage can because it was grayer, you know, or some sort of irrational explanation. And if this extreme view is true, then we think that a lot of our higher order decisions may come from pretty old parts of the brain, and we only rationalize them later.
So there's this secondary aspect to self-awareness that you study. Can you explain theory of mind?
Sure. The idea is that I have these thoughts, therefore, when I look across the room and I see another human being, I think that they have the same thoughts that I have. So I can think about what you're thinking about. I can think about what you're thinking about my thinking. And you can think about what I'm thinking about what you're thinking about my thinking. Right? And we can go back and forth with this like cognitive gymnastics where we get into each other's minds. And if I can think about my thoughts and my wife's thoughts, it makes for a much richer social interaction than if I'm only thinking about my thoughts, which does happen on occasion. So the idea is that having self-awareness leads to the awareness of others, which then allows for complex social interactions, really leads for a much richer life, particularly a much fuller social life.
And do these two things, my self-awareness and my awareness of you, do these things reinforce each other, have anything to do with each other?
Absolutely. So, you know, the way I see myself in part comes through your eyes. So if I know everybody in the room is thinking that, you know, I just played the worst guitar solo in the world, then I start to think I'm a very bad guitar player. So clearly, how I think about what you're thinking about me will influence ultimately how I think about me.
Are you saying we use other people as mirrors?
Absolutely. But it's also one of the greatest training tools, right? I mean, that's how we work with our kids. You know, I try to build up my daughter's self-confidence by telling her that, you know, she's the best hockey player in the world, and hopefully she'll start to believe it, and then that will improve her performance.
I just keep thinking that what you're saying is that much of our experience of life and of the world and even of ourselves is a lie.
Yeah, and you can either be depressed about it or just go for the ride. A lot of this remains still to be confirmed and replicated, but a lot of the indications are that we are living in a deceptive world at best, perhaps a false world in its most extreme.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what the consequences are of everything you've laid out. We have no free will. We're basically lying ourselves through life. What do you do with those insights? Should you just sit back and enjoy the dream, or should we all be meditating very hard and trying to lose our sense of self?
I'm going to go with the former. I think a lot of self-deception goes a long way, that giving yourself positive affirmations in the mirror, whether you believe them or not, would probably be the route I would suggest taking. You know, surrounding yourself with people who, even though you know they're lying to you, as long as they're saying good things, that's probably a healthy a healthy way to go. The alternative scares me. You know, we used to think people with clinical depression didn't see the world realistically. You know, they saw it in an overly negative light. Well, it turns out they're seeing it quite realistically, and it's you and I who are seeing it in an overly rosy light. You know, we're the ones not in reality. So the suggestion is that reality is a somewhat scary place to be.
So the purpose of therapy is to learn to be better at lying.
Absolutely. You know, that clearly puts into question this idea of deception is morality. Thou shalt not lie. Well, then thou shalt be depressed.
Do you ever wonder who we'd be if we didn't have any self-awareness?
You know, I wonder that about the chimpanzees, because clearly there are signs that they have some self-awareness. You know, maybe the Buddhists are onto something, that when you go on top of a mountain for 20 years, you know, you lose that sense of self. Maybe there's some serenity there. Well,
yeah.
There better be after 20 years. There better be something at the end.
But I think we do all have that feeling that we wish we could escape ourselves.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure Anheuser-Busch is very appreciative of that attitude. You know, I think that's why we have drugs and alcohol, and, you know, it's a way to get out of ourselves, you know, that inner voice or those introspective moments that are kind of painful.
Julian, this has been enlightening. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad we're still laughing.
I think that's all we can do, right?
That is all we can do. Thank you so much.
Julian Keenan is the author of The Face in the Mirror, How We Know Who We Are. He talked with Ann Strange Champs. Keenan's not convinced that it's possible or helpful to stop telling ourselves tales about who we are. So what have the mystics and contemplatives been talking about for ages? That egolessness is the one path to peace? Antoinette Varner, or Gangaji, as she's also known, is an American-born spiritual teacher. She says that even without decades of mountaintop meditation, we can stop spinning tales about who we are. And once we do, we'll see ourselves more clearly. Steve Paulson asked Gangaji her story of spiritual awakening.
Well, it's the story that ended my other story. I had reached a point in my life where I was dissatisfied with time spent correcting my story. And I really wondered whether it was possible to find fulfillment. I was successful. I was in a good relationship. And yet I was still yearning for something deeper. And I prayed for a teacher, and that prayer brought me to my teacher, H.W.L. Punja, and he told me to stop everything. And the way I heard that was to stop telling my story.
So you had to let go of your old story. Somehow that was getting in the way?
Well, I had tried to let go of it before, let me just preface it that way, and that really just meant exchanging it for a different version. Basically, it was a story of need. It was a story of longing. It began when I was a young child. I had a difficult home life in that I had alcoholic parents, and rightfully, I began seeking ways of getting out and getting a different story. I sought through success and through love relationships, and my story was a feminist, an enlightened person who saw what was true and saw what was real, and yet underneath that, I hadn't found lasting happiness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's fascinating because I think this is a common story for spiritual seekers. They work through various aspects of the earlier parts of their life and then go off and try to build a new identity. But there was something about that whole process that was getting in the way for you.
That's it, exactly. I think it's important to be able to create new identities. It certainly was for me. But until we recognize what both good stories and bad stories come from, and what is free of both, we are basically unfulfilled in a very deep sense.
Hmm. Can you give me an example of this, of what it would mean to oversee a story that we've told about ourselves and to learn from that in a new way?
I can remember an instance when I was just overcome with this grief of being an imperfect person. I was in my late 20s, a series of unfulfilling relationships and just the hormonal influx of being someone in their late 20s. And I was thrashing about in my bed one night over this story and feeling the emotional waves of grief and sadness and some anger. And somehow, internally heard myself saying, like, oh, I will never get it, it will never be right. And it was so familiar to me that I was willing to realize that I was feeding that with my attention and energy. I also recognized I was, in a weird kind of way, enjoying the suffering. I was generating a story that may have been totally legitimate at a certain time in my life, but by this time was simply an overlay of suffering. And I saw how invalid my story was. And I also saw there was the capacity to turn attention closer inward. Not only is the story illegitimate, but it's a covering, a cloaking for a natural joy, for natural mind, the Buddhists call it. One of our functions of the right brain is this universal field of openness. And it just seems that in our culture and in most cultures today, we have skewed our narratives to our left brain definitions and mental understanding, that we overlook this spacious, peaceful consciousness that is always present.
Is this what you learned from your teacher in India, the man who you call Papaji?
Well, he pointed me in this direction. He said, stop everything and discover who you are. To not lobotomize myself, but to consciously recognize the story and stop telling it for a moment of deep contemplation, then I could see that this life force and this wonder of life and this joy of being that was present when I was a young child, before I was identified as a suffering child, is still present now.
You know, a lot of people would say that they don't have a clue how to stop telling stories about themselves. That's kind of the way their minds work. And how do you get past that?
I understand that. It's, first of all, the willingness to overhear what your life story is. We are generating narrative, and we are often unaware of that. It just seems like a comment on reality. But when we can recognize that it's actually an interpretation of reality, then we have the opportunity to recognize what is under that, what is closer than the narrative. I don't like to set it up for people to have a formula that you shouldn't tell a story, that stories are wrong, because I don't believe that's true. I think it is the way we are made. And before we are storytellers, we are conscious beings. We are aware of this sense, I am. And that sense is underneath all stories.
But what I guess I'm trying to figure out what that is. What is underneath the story? I mean, if you get rid of all the story that we tell about ourselves, what's left?
Conscious silence. And even those words, of course, we have stories attached to those words. They may be too heavy. If we actually just call it I, or that, or it, we then can discover that it's always present and it is fulfilled in itself. It is life aware of itself as consciousness through the mechanism of a human being's brain.
Are you talking about this state of quietness, of being, as something that you experience in a contemplative state? I don't know, when you're meditating or something? Are you talking about this just as you go about your daily life?
Well, I'm talking about it being possible to discover that whatever you're experiencing, if you take a moment, you will find it. But it does require a moment of retreat from the day-to-day story. We have meditation experiences that are extraordinary and wonderful, but they come and go. This doesn't come and go. The experiences come and go in this. This is the truth of oneself. It's the open mind. It's the natural mind. I would say that the word fulfillment or profound contentment is what it's like.
But it sounds like it could also be pretty scary. I mean, you're talking about giving up your natural defenses.
That's right. It can be pretty scary. I mean, we have protective personae, and those are appropriate in certain circumstances. What I'm speaking of is being naked to yourself, to not be fooled by your cloaking devices or your narratives. And then if it's appropriate that you act a certain way or you repress a certain emotion or you express a certain emotion, that's just in the play of life. You aren't fooling yourself.
Was it hard for you to learn how to do this?
Well, it was scary. I thought you used the right word. When I really heard my teacher say stop, I was afraid I would regress.
When your teacher said stop, what did he mean? What was he telling you to stop?
Well, he was telling me to stop searching. And all narrative is about some search, protection or connection or safety. But not to stop searching in the way of resignation and falling asleep, to stay conscious and open and stop. And it was terrifying to me.
It sounds like there's a paradox at the center of what you're talking about.
Isn't there always?
I mean, you had to get to a deeper place. You had to let go. I mean, there were techniques to figure out how to do this, and yet your teacher was saying, stop searching for enlightenment. Stop trying so hard. Just do it somehow.
Just open to it. Just recognize you are it. And we are so trained to do something, to actually have the invitation to stop doing anything, to recognize who you are, is very threatening to the whole structure of our narrative. What is this I that everyone, every human being uses in a certain way? If we stop collecting identity from narratives about inward and outward events, and instead just turn our attention to the I itself, what do we find?
Now, one of the questions we're talking around, it seems to me, is whether there's really such a thing as a self, as the I that you were just talking about. I mean, we all have this intuitive sense, the essence of who we are. But if you talk to neuroscientists, they will say that self is a fiction. There's no part of the brain that produces this sense of self. Instead, you know, the brain produces these narratives, constructs these stories. So I guess I have to ask, do you think the self is real?
I think the I that we produce is a fiction. But where it comes from and what enlivens that production is the truth of oneself. And whether that's just a neurological truth or spiritual truth is finally irrelevant, because it's an alive, conscious awareness. I am aware is primary. And then the fiction comes in when being what? Being somebody. And we are great fiction tellers, and fiction is thrilling. It's just not the truth. Maybe the reverse of Descartes' I think, therefore I am. It's I am, therefore I think.
Gangaji's latest book is Hidden Treasure, Uncovering the Truth in Your Life Story. Steve Paulson spoke with her. You can hear the uncut version of this interview on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Gangaji's take on self is simple. Forget your story and zoom in on the experience of consciousness. But Jonathan Harris wants to zoom out. Harris is the creator behind We Feel Fine, I Want You to Want Me, and other projects that use new media to reflect human experience. In his latest work, he's bringing together a community of storytellers in the hope that combining our individual stories might reveal the ecstatic truth of human life. And Strainchamps asked Harris to explain his storytelling platform called Cowbird.
It's a few things. I think the way I could most succinctly describe it is that it's a very simple tool that anyone can use to tell very beautiful stories on the web. And it allows you to collaborate with other people in telling the stories of the larger sagas that are happening in the world. So sagas is this concept that's really core to Cowbird. And it's this idea that there are these news events now, things like the Japanese earthquake and the Indian tsunami and the Arab Spring and the war in Iraq and more recently here at home, the Occupy Wall Street movement. These things that happen in a very decentralized, complex, quickly changing, unpredictable dynamic, and they touch many, many people's lives. And so Cowbird presents a new way to try to cover those types of stories using very simple human stories, the things that you or I might stumble into in an afternoon. Like, I've been spending a lot of time up at Occupy Oakland. One night, these anarchist kids had broken into a building, and about 300 police in full riot gear had formed lines, and they were about to fire these tear gas canisters into the crowd. And there was this general feeling of hysteria. And I noticed this young couple in their early 20s that were just standing in the middle of all of this chaos, and they were just kissing each other. And I saw this, and I took a picture of it, and I thought, that's what it's all about. And I think if there's a message in Cowbird, that is the message, that this crazy stuff is raging all around us in the world, yet we still find a way to be who we are as individuals. And so it's really like humanizing the news.
So if you were going to turn that into a story or post on Cowbird, what would you do? What would it look like?
So that is actually a story that I have up there right now. And what it consists of is the photograph that I took of this couple with the people running around them and them kissing in the middle of the craziness. And then I just wrote up a little vignette about what it felt like at that moment, the things I heard around me, what it smelled like, what it looked like. And then there's lots of metadata about that moment in my life, like where it took place, when it took place, who was there, what it was about. And all of that metadata becomes connection points so you can see that story in context and see other things that relate to it.
You were talking about sagas. How would that post that you made of that moment of the couple kissing with chaos swirling around them, how would that connect into the larger saga of the Occupy story?
Sure. So the way Cowbird works is that it allows anybody to keep a diary of their life, and that diary consists of individual stories. So that story of the couple kissing is part of my personal diary. But I've also flagged that story as being relevant to the Occupy saga. It shows up both in my diary and also as part of the broader Occupy saga, to which many, many different people are contributing.
You know, it's fascinating. It sounds like you're inventing a new way of dealing with a huge volume of stories.
Yeah, and specifically, I'm interested in finding a deeper way, because one thing that we all feel now is we're just drowning in data all of the time. And one thing I've been noticing is that throughout history, communication has been getting shorter and shorter and more fractured. So you start with things like letter writing, which is very deep and slow, and then you move into phone calls, and then you move into faxes, and then you move into emails. Now we're kind of hovering around tweets as the canonical form of communication right now. But it's unclear to me that there's another level of compression after the tweet, unless we start going around and making monosyllabic grunts at each other or something like this. So I think, you know, we're at this interesting point where, in a way, we've reached the terminal velocity of how fast our communication can go. And then a question arises, which is, well, do we stay there? Do we keep tweeting? Or do we hit some kind of wall and bounce back in the other direction, suddenly starting to crave a little bit more depth and substance again? And I'm betting on that. Cowbird is really putting a flag in the sand and saying, this is a space on the internet which is dedicated to deeper, longer-lasting, more nourishing storytelling than you're going to find anywhere else.
I'm curious, why the name Cowbird?
It's a funny name, and basically the reason for that is to try to combine the traits of a cow and a bird together. So when I think about a cow, you know, I think of something very slow and steady and methodical. And when I think of a bird, I think of something very fast and free and loose and joyful. And I think the internet recently, things like Twitter and Facebook, have been all bird and no cow. And then you have more traditional mediums like novels and operas, which are like all cow and no bird. And so this project is really trying to combine those two extremes to create an experience that's both contemplative and deep and nourishing, but that's also very fast and efficient and joyful and fun to use. I think the technologies we've seen in the last few years have been very good at feeding the kind of frantic, compulsive side of us. But I think there's this other side of us that's been starving, and that other side has more to do with plumbing the depths and really connecting with people on a deeper level and really studying your own experience also in a deeper, longer-lasting way.
When you were talking about gathering all of these individual stories that are part of sagas, it kind of sounds like crowdsourced news, and yet these stories, some may be news stories, true stories, but some might not be. Does it matter if they're true?
It doesn't really matter. It's more the feeling. There's this idea that, you see this sometimes in like the novels of Tolstoy or the movies of Werner Herzog or Chinese epic poetry, where basically you have this situation where there's many, many, many individual elements, and no one of these elements really tells you the whole story. And when you start to get enough of these things coming together, this kind of feeling starts to emerge. And I think that that feeling that comes through is actually closer to the truth of the thing than any one account of it could ever be. And it's not necessarily the factual truth. It's more the idea of the poetic truth. And with Cowbird, I can spend time telling these stories. And as I do so, my overall life story becomes more and more beautiful. And I'm also contributing to the larger collective stories that we're all taking part in. And those collective stories also become more beautiful as I do my little part to tell my stories.
There's a line at the bottom of the screen on Cowbird, goes, to be a witness to life. What does that mean to you?
For me, that's really the purpose of this project. There's this idea that as we live our lives, we see stuff and we notice things. And most of the time, we're too busy to write those things down or to tell anybody else about it. And I think there's almost a responsibility we have as individuals to tell other people about the things that we notice, that we feel have some kind of resonance. And this has been a dream of mine for many years, to create a kind of public library for human experience. And if there were such a library for human experience, the lessons that we learn as individuals, the wisdom that we gain as individuals, could outlive us and could become part of the commons so that other people can look to them for guidance, people living now and also people in future generations.
You know, there's this growing body of neuroscience suggesting that humans are literally hardwired to seek and to make stories, that that's what our brains do all day long. Mm-hmm. Do you think all of your computer interactive projects are doing something similar? Are you building something like a great big story-making brain in a cloud?
I tend not to think about it as some kind of computer intelligence like that. I really see it as individual people with individual agency over their individual stories. And when you put enough of those together, you do start to get this kind of meta thing coming through. But I'm really not so much after the meta thing coming through. I'm really after giving people as individuals a rich experience. When it comes to storytelling itself, it is something that's very deep in us. And I think the role that it plays has to do with organizing our experience so that we can make sense of it.
And not just stories, I think, because with your reference to sagas, I think you were, you know, kind of invoking myth. And I think that's when we can all tell a story about, you know, the thing that happened to me yesterday on the way to the supermarket and the funny person I met and blah, blah, blah. But some stories are better than others. You must clearly be wanting to create a level of story that is more like myth than like anecdote.
Exactly, yeah. That's important to me. And the way I think that you do that at web scale is you have to get lots and lots of people telling stories. And then a few of them will be like these little sparkling gems. And a lot of them won't be so interesting. But that's actually okay, because even the most banal, badly photographed, poorly written story that you can imagine will still be very interesting to the people who love the person who wrote that story. And what you have to do as a system designer is you have to make sure that only the really great ones are the ones that most people bump into when they're looking around the site, but that even the less great ones are still there and they still have a home and they still have a purpose. I'm not trying to create an elitist ecosystem of excellent storytellers, although Calvert is really designed for great storytellers to use, but it's also designed for anybody to use. And the system will kind of sort them out so that as a viewer, you're exposed to the ones that are going to be interesting to you.
Jonathan Harris is the founder of Cowbird. You can find a link to the project and to Anne Strangechamp's uncut conversation with him on our website, ttbook.org. Meanwhile, here's a taste of some of the audio stories from Cowbird Storytellers.
This is my Uncle Frank, Frank Glazer. Frank is 95 years old. Frank still plays concert piano. He still teaches at Bates College.
One night, I came upstairs and she had a dramatic look on her face. Her eyes were closed. "What's wrong, Nani? Are you okay?" I asked. "No, darling," she said. "I'm dead." "No, you're not. You're fine. We're all here, downstairs." "Oh, damn," she replied. "I was sure this time."
As the insane woman of Benigànim spoke in tongues and protested, a small kitten sat on the threshold of her doorstep and simply gazed at me. The train pulled into the station and finally the woman fell silent.
I was a 68 whiskey, which is classified as a healthcare specialist. We were combat medics is what we called ourselves because we were in a combat unit. So there was some weird thing inside me that wanted that combat experience.
Look at her face. You could not paint anything like this. It is so silent.
The female of the species throughout all of nature is destined for motherhood.
Some of us try to deny the fact that we exist in duality. As time passes by, I realize that we cycle through partners that resemble our nature and those that oppose it. All of us are simultaneously afraid to die and to live. I guess we can call that state of oscillation present tense.
Short remembrance of a space briefly shared, of a time briefly cared for. And then I had loved you deeply for your words. How with a turn of phrase, you turn the world on its face. Not out of malice, but out of grace.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and agitators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Stories of You. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.